Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The Florida legislature may have passed a budget and a tidy package of bills, but that doesn't mean Governor Rick Scott has to sign them.
I've got a lot of options. I can veto the whole budget. I can veto a portion of the budget, a line of the budget, and I can do special sessions. So I'm looking at all those options.
Also tonight, Florida Senate President Joe Negron's top legislative priority becomes reality with Governor Scott's signature.
The footprint of this reservoir is important, but what's most vital is the volume that this reservoir will hold. We've never said that this project will end discharges.
We'll also find out which issues didn't get the nod from lawmakers this year, including a few that have the force of a constitutional amendment behind them. I'm Tom Flanagan with your direct weekly connection to the latest news from state government and the Florida legislature. Welcome to Capitol Report. Although some folks, notably the Speaker of the Florida House, railed a lot this session against the government picking winners and losers, there are always plenty of both in the wake of every legislative session. And here's one example. Florida's charter schools have emerged as winners from the legislative session. The schools have won long-fought battles over local revenue and where and how they can expand. But even supporters say some of those victories are likely to end up in court. And Governor Rick Scott is under pressure to veto those policies and the education budget, as we hear from Lynn Hatter.
Charter schools are considered public schools in Florida. They're part of school districts but aren't subjected to many of the same rules. There are about 600 charters in the state, and they've long fought for more financial parity with traditional schools. This year, they got closer to it with lawmakers requiring districts to share both local and federal funding. Chris Moya with the firm's Jones Walker lobbies for Charter Schools USA.
What this bill did is actually say, no, no, no. If Timmy generated X number of dollars in his district, and if Timmy generated X number of dollars in Title I funding, and the state has dedicated $7,000, all that money goes to whichever public school Timmy goes. And I can't see anybody, if you do it from the student's perspective, I would challenge anyone to argue that the dollars shouldn't follow the student.
Charters have historically received less money than their traditional counterparts due to districts not sharing those federal and local funds with them. But lawmakers may have swung the pendulum too far in the other direction. School districts are saying they could lose millions of dollars under the plans. The money shift, coupled with a meager increase in the K-12 budget, means many districts will lose money. Speaking before the State Board of Education, Miami-Dade Superintendent Alberto Carvalho took aim at the legislature's education budget and its policy decisions, like requiring districts to share local dollars. He says it's a $40 million hit to Miami-Dade schools in the first year alone.
We will be forced to either accept a downgrade to our recently improved credit rating disposition by Standard & Poor's and Moody's, or we will have to eliminate, shut down, or reduce the capital outlay plan, particularly schools that are in dire need of investment in renovation, or we will have to reduce the workforce that protects those environments. No matter what, the financial viability of the capital program shall be jeopardized.
The Florida Association of District School Superintendents, the Association of School Boards, and the State Teachers Union are all calling for a veto of the House's education bill and for reconsideration of the education budget. Some Tea Party groups have made similar calls, too. And Governor Rick Scott has signaled that he's listening.
I've got a lot of options. I can veto the whole budget. I can veto a portion of the budget, a line of the budget, and I can do special sessions. So I'm looking at all those options.
If Scott signs off on the education measures, Charter Schools USA lobbyist Chris Moya believes groups will end up in court.
Big victories for students, especially. I think my thoughts would be the following. One, this is certainly going to land us all in court. I truly believe that the issue is so great that we will end up somehow in some way in litigation over some of this language.
Neither of the two major pieces of education legislation have made it to Scott's desk. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
And as long as we're on the subject of winners, this week Governor Rick Scott handed Senate President Joe Negron a big win by signing Senate Bill 10 that clears the way for a $1.2 billion reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee. Everglades Foundation CEO Eric Eichenberg spoke with Florida Public Radio's Jim Ash about the significance of the project and what happens next.
I'm speaking with Eric Eichenberg. He is the head of the Everglades Foundation. He's celebrating a legislative victory. Governor Rick Scott just signed Senate Bill 10. Senate Bill 10 isn't a set of engineering drawings for the reservoir. It's essentially some marching orders for the South Florida Water Management District, isn't it?
That's right, Jim. Thanks for having me on. It's just to take a step back to realize that this reservoir project that the governor signed with Senate Bill 10 has been in existence, if you will, for 17 years. And what I mean by that is the United States Congress and the President of the United States passed and signed historic Everglades restoration back in the year 2000. So 17 years ago, a list of projects were agreed upon. And the second project that the Congress approved back then was this need for a reservoir south of the lake. What occurred here this time is we had a 242-day state of emergency last year due to the fact we had toxic algae in Lake Okeechobee, and that water was causing alga blooms, loss of jobs, small businesses being impacted, tourism, all of the negative impacts that we saw from blue-green algae in our waterways. And fishermen, boaters, realtors, again, small business owners, the business community stepped up in a massive way to tell legislators across the board in both political parties that something needed to be happened. They realized this southern reservoir was the key point of redirecting that lake water down to the Florida Keys.
Well, there is a bigger picture here, Eric. I mean, the original proposal, of course, mentioned 60,000 acres and didn't quite come up with the same acreage in the compromise. You've been careful in describing the project to say that it will significantly reduce the algal problems we talked about, and nothing's going to cure them, I suppose. Is this going to be enough to make a significant difference?
Well, that's the whole point, is it needs to make significant difference. Having a bill signing and a balloon drop for another legislative accomplishment is all fine and dandy. But unless this has meaningful storage south of the lake, and the 60,000 acres that were part of the plan Congress passed 17 years ago does discuss or does call out for that 360,000 acre feet, roughly 120 billion gallons of water. When you have smaller acreage, then the issue is this reservoir goes higher. So with less land, you just have to build higher, because the whole point of this effort is the sheer volume of water. And that water just doesn't stay in this reservoir. The reservoir would fill up, and then that water is gradually released into these wetlands, into these man-made wetlands. The water is cleansed, and then we're delivering clean water through the central Everglades. And there's a key project to remove barriers that don't allow a natural flow south. That water will go into the central Everglades. Currently, we're bridging Tamiami Trail, US 41, from Tampa to Miami. Tamiami Trail, that road is being raised, and 12-foot bridges are being constructed. So water will flow into Everglades National Park. The footprint of this reservoir is important, but what's most vital is the volume that this reservoir will hold. We've never said that this project will end discharges. The only way to end discharges is to have expanded storage within the peninsula. And that storage concern or that storage need certainly goes beyond this particular Senate Bill 10.
Governor Scott signed the legislation into law. Technically or procedurally, what happens next?
Well, the legislation has a number of dates and deliverables that need to be occurred. For listeners, the bottom line here is the United States Congress, within the next 18 months, has to provide a authorization for this reservoir. And we've been working with the congressional delegation, Mr. Rooney, Mr. Mast, both of our senators here in Florida. The Florida congressional delegation is going to play a role in allowing this reservoir to be built and come online within the next number of years, a handful of years. The last thing, Jim, is on the dates is January the 9th, the start of the next legislative session in Tallahassee. The Water Management District has to deliver a report to the President and the Speaker on the progress moving forward. The next 18 months are critical so we can get it. And other members from around the country, congressmen and women from around the country who have come to Florida to see our challenges and our water crises are standing ready to help because they understand this is a national treasure. You have two federal parks with a whole host of other federal installations here in the state. This is America's Everglades. We're all in it together.
Eric Eichenberg, CEO of the Everglades Foundation, thank you very much for your help.
Jim, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Still to come on Capitol Report, lawmakers are wondering whether they'll be called back to the Capitol to pass cannabis legislation after the chambers couldn't find compromise.
I would describe the way that the legislature handled medical marijuana this year as schizophrenic.
Florida environmentalists say they're disappointed the legislature didn't fund Florida Forever this year. The legislature directed funding toward water projects instead of land conservation. Will Abiger with the Trust for Public Land says lawmakers also keep diverting trust fund money for land conservation for other purposes.
Buying pickup trucks and funding salaries and buying computers and just the everyday things that the agencies have to do to operate. That was not what voters approved in 2014.
This year's session was the first chance for lawmakers to address lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender issues after the Pulse shooting in Orlando. The legislature chose not to address civil rights protections, but activists are still claiming a victory.
44% of the legislature has endorsed the Competitive Workforce Act by co-sponsoring it, and that's unheard of.
And reforms could be in the works next year to change Florida's process that adequately compensates victims who sue the government.
It's incredibly unfair. People wait for decades to have relief because of the caps that are placed.
The medical marijuana industry is lurching forward as lawmakers consider whether and how to call a special session. Nick Evans has more.
When lawmakers dropped the hankies and left the Capitol, new medical cannabis legislation was left lying on the scrap heap. But for the existing industry, business marches on. Knox Medical just opened their first retail dispensary in Gainesville, and they're preparing to open one in Orlando. CEO Jose Hidalgo says he's planning on more, but he's not sure how many yet.
To the extent that we feel we have a good distribution and good access for patients, I think we're going to be happy. I think it's very early to answer that question. Time will tell.
But the news hasn't been quite so sanguine for other growers. Trulieve got a cease and desist letter for selling a so-called full flower product meant for a vaporizer. State health officials objected because users could potentially remove and smoke the buds. Trulieve has taken the product off its shelves, but there's confusion because the company says it's been selling similar products for nearly a year.
I'd like to see us address the issue in a special session. I've expressed that to President Negron.
This is Senator Rob Bradley. The Fleming Island Republican led the unsuccessful bid to lock down an implementing bill for last year's medical marijuana amendment.
A lot of really good patient-friendly language is in the bills that the House and the Senate passed. We just have the issue of how many dispensaries each license holder will be able to have.
As the legislative session wound down, House and Senate sponsors sparred over capping the number of retail facilities. The Senate pitched limiting dispensaries at 5. The House offered 50, and then amended its proposal to 100. St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis is fed up.
I would describe the way that the legislature handled medical marijuana this year as schizophrenic.
Brandis points to loosely worded contracting provisions and the back and forth over capping dispensaries.
Well, I think it's largely because there's no cohesive vision of ultimately how we want this to play out. Right? I think that's the overriding theme is You have reluctant champions and you have a disjointed vision.
Rather than renovating current statutes, Brandis says lawmakers should start from scratch. In a letter to Senate President Joe Negron, he argues for abandoning the current system of vertical integration, where each licensee is responsible for growing, processing, and selling the drug. It echoes legislation Brandis filed this year that failed to gain traction. So far, House Speaker Richard Corcoran has voiced his support for a special session, but Negron is still weighing his options. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
The Florida legislature directed funding toward water projects instead of land conservation this year, but environmental groups complain that the state has still not fully implemented the land conservation constitutional amendment. That story now from Sarah Mueller.
Apalachicola Riverkeeper Dan Tensmeyer is working to get 40,000 acres along the river onto the Florida Forever priority project list. He says the proposed conservation easement will protect fish and wildlife in the floodplain.
I think this is a very important and even critical acquisition for the continued protection of the Apalachicola. We have seen in other areas how development in the floodplain can harm the downstream resources.
But the project will have to wait until state lawmakers appropriate money to the fund. Legislators approved $1.2 billion for a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee, but decided not to fund land conservation. Legislators also approved $150 million for the Everglades and $50 million for Springs. The reservoir was a high priority for Senate President Joe Negron, quote, father of Florida Forever, and Budget Chairman Senator Jack Latvala says he was okay with defunding land conservation to get Negron his reservoir. But he says he'll put funding for land conservation in the budget next year.
But I think if you look at the totality of our budget and look at what we're doing for Lake Okeechobee, the Everglades, Springs, Lake Apopka, the St. John's River, the total environment of our beaches, that, and I don't know this for a fact, I said the other day, I don't want to be politifacted on this, but I believe you're going to probably find there's more money in this budget for the environment than we've had in a long time.
But Will Abiger with the Trust for Public Land has heard wait until next year from legislators before. He says the state diverts money from the trust fund for other purposes. Environmental groups filed a lawsuit in 2015 saying the diversions are unconstitutional. The lawsuit was on hold during the session.
In any given year since the amendment was passed, about a quarter to a third of the funding has been used for existing agency operations, for buying pickup trucks and funding salaries and buying computers and just the everyday things that the agencies have to do to operate. That was not what voters approved in 2014.
Florida Forever was created in 1999 to fund buying land. Voters overwhelmingly approved creating a land acquisition trust fund in 2014. The amendment dedicates a third of the revenue from the document stamps tax for land conservation, including wetlands, fish and wildlife habitats, and protecting water resources and water quality. Legislation funding Florida Forever passed the Florida House earlier this month, but died in the Senate. Representative Ben Diamond says the proposal didn't give enough to Florida Forever projects that have more merit.
Yet despite that, the bill before us allocates more funds toward the rural and family lands projects and less toward Florida Forever.
Florida currently manages about 10 million acres of conservation land. Some lawmakers say capital projects like new reservoirs should also get trust fund money. Some also say they want more land to be subject to property taxes. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
After a gunman killed 49 people at a gay nightclub in Orlando, the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community worked to translate grief into political action. Even though attempts to pass civil rights protections in the state house failed again this year, Kate Payne reports LGBTQ activists are claiming a victory.
Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Floridians can legally be fired for being who they are.
We need action by Governor Rick Scott. We need action by our leaders in the Florida legislature. to remedy these issues.
Michael Farmer is with the LGBTQ rights group Equality Florida.
To pass a statewide anti-discrimination law to make sure that these people who, God bless them, survived this and, you know, are going to have to live with this for the rest of their life cannot be fired next week just because of who they are.
That statement came just days after an attacker gunned down 49 people, many of them gay and Latino, at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. The attack illuminated the discrimination the LGBTQ community still faces. Employment, housing, and public accommodation are not guaranteed under the law.
We decided that we would honor them with action.
Hannah Willard is a lobbyist for Equality Florida.
That everything we did would be dedicated to lifting up the victims, lifting up the survivors, and making sure that we are calling folks to action.
The organization has been working on civil rights protections for years. And Willard says there is historic support this year for what's called the Competitive Workforce Act.
44% of the legislature has endorsed the Competitive Workforce Act by co-sponsoring it. And that's unheard of. That's not just a pledge to vote for it. That's these legislators saying that they want to put their names on our top legislative priority.
This is an issue that's been on my mind and heart for a long time.
That's Clearwater Republican Senator Jack Latvala speaking in February 2016.
I don't support discrimination in any way, shape, or form for any reason. We're all human beings. We're all deserving of the same opportunities as the next person.
Latvala is part of a group of powerful, high-profile Republican lawmakers who signed on to the bill. Another key co-sponsor, freshman Democratic Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith of Orlando. He's the state's first openly gay Latino lawmaker and a former lobbyist for Equality Florida. Despite a historic lawmaker, historic support, and the weight of the nation's worst mass shooting in recent history, the bill failed. In fact, it didn't get a single hearing. Here's Willard.
It seemed as though legislative leadership didn't want to deal with LGBT issues, for better or for worse.
Smith also sponsored a ban on assault rifles, which would have prohibited the sale of high-capacity weapons like the one the Pulse shooter used. He says the tragedy fuels his position on gun control.
So it's very real for those of us who are here in this community, and that has helped me maintain my focus and my passion.
Lawmakers ultimately blocked the ban. One step the legislature did take, adding new criminal penalties for terrorism. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, among the many Tallahassee truisms, is that it usually takes more than one gathering of Florida lawmakers to get many things done. It's not unusual for certain bills to reappear each year for several years before they finally make it through the legislative process successfully. Two Florida lawmakers are already looking ahead to next year's legislative session to revive a bipartisan effort to reform the state's claims bill process. As Sasha Cordner reports, it allows those who sue a government agency over things like injuries or negligence to receive the rest of the money awarded to them, a process that can often take years.
In 2012, Mary Mifflin G. was having a seizure in a parking lot, and the city of Miami's fire rescue responded.
And as they loaded Ms. Mifflin G. out of the car, she was not strapped properly to the gurney. As they tried to put her into the ambulance, she fell out, striking her head violently.
So Dania Beach Democratic Representative Evan Jenny says, as a result, Mary Mifflin G. suffered a severe traumatic brain injury.
She underwent a left craniectomy, a cranioplasty, a number of different issues that have come up. Where she is numerous complication, dysphagia, hypertension, anemia of chronic disease, acute renal failure, respiratory distress, urinary tract infections, rectal bleeding, and deep vein thrombosis.
In 2013, Mary's sister, who's now her legal guardian, filed a lawsuit. The city of Miami agreed to settle for $2.5 million in 2015. Mary has received $200,000, but to get the rest, she needed legislative approval through what's known as the claims bill process. Jenny agreed to sponsor that bill this year, and it's one of the 13 claims bills sent to the governor for approval. This is the first time that claims bill was ever filed. That's unusual in a process that's often called flawed. Victims usually have to wait years to get legislative approval, even if all parties agreed on the settled claim. It's why Jenny says the claims bill process needs to be reformed. He'd filed two other claims bills this year. Both died in the legislative committee process. So Jenny, along with Tampa Republican James Grant, filed a measure to do just that, but it never got taken up in any committees. Still, Jenny says they'll be back next year.
Representative Jamie Grant, a Republican from the West Coast, and I'm a Democrat from the East Coast, we're working together on a bill to do just that, to reform that process. We've already started working with the chairs who might see that bill next year to find out what they need to see in it in order for it to get a hearing. So that's one that I'm going to definitely be bringing back. And I've made a commitment, and so is Representative Grant. So I'm going to keep carrying that bill until we get it done.
State Representative Grant chaired a committee on claims bills in 2013. At the time, he'd intended to put forth a committee bill to change the current claims bill process. Now he says he's trying to put a lot of those ideas into a bill everyone can get behind.
Yeah, I think it kind of stems out of some effort we've had in the House over the last few years. Representative Jenny and myself both feel passionate that the process ought to be a lot more transparent. It ought to be a lot less dependent on who your lobbyist is. Somebody who has legitimately, wrongfully been injured ought to not have to be subject to the chaos that sometimes is this process. So I think we're looking again next year.
While there was no Senate companion this year, Grant says there may be some senators willing to sponsor it next year.
Unfortunately, the Senate didn't file a bill this year. I think Senator Hudson's very interested, and others, to work with us to work on some of the reforms that came out of the select committee I chaired that we had in the House a couple years ago.
The bill includes a provision raising a local government's initial payout to a victim from the present $200,000 cap to $1 million. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Regular Capital Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Kortner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capital Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capital Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capital Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.